So welcome to the talk on retirement income solutions in the 21st century. It should be a very interesting session, I think. We've got two very experienced people here to talk to us, Anton Capel and John Nicholas. First of all, Anton Capel, he's currently working at AMP, where he's the Deputy Group Actuary and also the Appointed Actuary of NMLA. He joined AMP in 2014 after 20 years at Towers Watson. And at Towers Watson, Anton was head of the Australian Risk Consulting Team and leader of the Asia-Pacific Risk Management Product Group. He also has experience working across the Asia-Pacific region and in Europe. And his areas of practice include risk and capital management, economic valuations, distribution profitability and product design and pricing of products ranging from investment guarantees to home equity release products. We also have John Nichols. He's based in Melbourne. He's a senior consultant with the risk consulting and software business of Towers Watson. He joined Towers Watson Australia in 1990 and has actually done a couple of four-year stints in both the US and then the Brazil offices, which would have been really interesting. His work includes helping clients develop a broad range of insurance products, advising on design, costing, reserving and capital requirements for investment guarantees and the application of Australian IFRS base accounting standards. He also helps clients develop financial projections for mergers and acquisitions, strategic planning, market entry and company licensing. I'll now hand over to Anton to kick off the presentation.
Okay, good afternoon everyone, welcome. Just looking around the room, I think a large number of you were in the earlier session that I was in on retirement incomes. I think there are sort of a few papers at this conference on retirement incomes, and one of the themes, if you like, running through them is stochastic analysis of the impact of our choices in terms of selecting retirement income products. I think in the earlier session, for those who were there, there were some, I guess, conclusions drawn, some modelled different outcomes with the aim of trying to identify what might be an optimal strategy. In our paper, we haven't really attempted to do that, more sort of raised a number of questions that need to be addressed in trying to arrive at an optimal solution, and in particular, dealing with some of the complexities in sort of thinking about how you define how to measure what an optimal outcome is. I guess, you know, where would this sort of approach be used? So I think the obvious example is if you're an individual who's retiring and is trying to make a retirement decision, but other obvious uses are manufacturers looking to design products for customers, or super fund trustees if the CIPR concept gets up and trustees have to offer a default retirement product. You know, there are some difficult, complex issues for them to think through in choosing what to offer their members. But also policymakers, I think it is a complex area, and it's not simple to be able to design or even think about what's best for individuals in this area. The presentation that we have today basically follows the structure of the paper. I'm expecting most of you will not have read the paper, given we only submitted it yesterday. I think there is one person in the room who was very keen and did manage to find it in the last 12 hours. So apologies for those who may have wanted to look at it before today. But we sort of start with some basic concepts, looking at sort of individuals' income needs, talk about the assets and liabilities that individuals hold. And then, as I said, it's really an illustrative analysis of how you might go about selecting a retirement strategy. And finally, we close with some takeaway messages. So first concept, I guess it's fairly obvious to everyone in this room, but it is something that I do want to labour and really make the point that cash flows are uncertain. So retirement solutions are aimed around providing an income in retirement to meet, you know, what we talk about in the papers of needs and wants, if you like, of individuals. But for a variety of reasons, those needs and wants are uncertain. Certain cash flows are quite predictable. So, for example, we all need to eat. Others are discretionary. So you may choose to go on a holiday. You may choose to eat caviar. And for an individual, the boundary between what's an essential spend and what's a discretionary spend, you know, will vary depending on, you know, your background, your financial resources, your level of confidence about the future and so on. There are also sort of uncertain costs in terms of sort of lumpy things that may or may not be needed. You may need to replace a car, you may need to modify your house to make it wheelchair accessible and so on. There's the question of longevity. I think everyone's familiar with that. Nobody knows how long they're going to live. So therefore the period over which they'll need to fund an income. We also obviously don't know how investment markets will perform, so investing in products that expose you to investment market risk creates uncertainty. We don't know what inflation will do, what basic spending needs, how that cost will evolve over time. And I guess all those risks are sort of fairly often discussed. The one risk that I don't too often see discussed or not discussed in too much detail is the risk around government policy. So obviously tax is sort of touched on reasonably often, but the age pension, everyone sort of assumes that the age pension is there as a backstop, but I'm not sure how many people would be confident if they were retiring, say, age 65 today, that they'd be comfortable with whatever the government in power 30, 35 years from now was going to be offering people as an age pension. So there's sort of significant uncertainty in a range of areas impacting people's retirement income. So after that sort of introduction, I should say we don't really discuss most of those uncertainties in the paper, but it is critical to have them in mind when talking about retirement solutions. The other thing that we should sort of bear in mind is how people respond to uncertainty. So one of the presentations earlier today talked about behavioural economics principles, and a couple of them are particularly relevant to retirement incomes. Overconfidence and optimism. So people sort of faced with the risk of things may be bad tend to discount it. Hyperbolic discounting. So people prefer a dollar now than, say, $1.50 tomorrow. In the case of retirement incomes, where we're talking 30-plus years out into the future, that makes decision-making extremely difficult, or making optimal decision-making difficult. And the concept of loss aversion, so people dislike losing something twice as much as they value gaining something. So that will play into, for example, people's preferences for locking in say a lifetime annuity or even buying into a group self-annuitisation type scheme. And all of those basic behavioural biases will compromise people's ability to make optimal decisions. We talk about the concept of a personal balance sheet in the paper. So it's probably nothing surprising here if people look at that. This question, you know, it's sort of got it, all your assets there. It's got all your basic liabilities. There's an, you know, equity item, which is the balancing item. But there are some sort of important things missing, which are all the intangibles. So things like your future earning stream. So obviously depending on your age, for young people, their biggest asset is their future earning potential. There may be other assets like a potential future inheritance, potential future government support from the age pension or other support, potential for family, for your kids to support you in your old age. So various other assets, but also liabilities like your future spending as an obvious liability. And sort of broken down into those categories of what you need to spend, what you want to spend, and other sort of ad hoc costs that may or may not arise. And the last one we listed there was bequests. And a lot of the studies in this area show that a lot of people sort of don't spend as much as they could in retirement from a desire to leave a bequest to their children when they die. Here we've sort of presented a sort of another version of that, which is sort of more reflective of what someone's balance sheet may look like at retirement. So in all the research that we've done at AMP, we've come to the view that, you know, retirement isn't a point in time. Your retirement's a journey. People sort of ebb and flow through a phase of moving from full-time work to full-time retirement and ultimately to decline and death. But for the purposes of this paper, we sort of assumed that, you know, retirement's a point in time event, age 65, and have done sort of modelling on that basis. But obviously at retirement, you know, once you've completely stopped work, you have no future earnings, you've got your basic financial resources, the assets that you've accumulated through your working lifetime, and you know, essentially all your future income needs. So to summarise, we start with this concept of personal balance sheet and the need for an individual to fund their uncertain future income needs with their sort of finite resources at retirement. And as I mentioned before, what we've tried to do in the paper is present a framework for assessing how different financial products or different strategies for combining financial products could be used to help people optimise their retirement incomes. And before I hand over to John, what we found is that there really isn't any, certainly no sort of universally agreed metric for how to weigh up different options or different strategies. But there are, you know, a couple of concepts that we've floated as potential ways to allow people to trade off different concepts, but it really will come down to individual risk preferences as to how that should best be done. So now I'll hand over to John to take you through the modelling work that we've done.
Thanks, Anton. Thanks, everyone. Before I sort of move on to the modelling, just come back to what Anton said about retirement being a journey, and you know, we talked a little bit there about the personal balance sheet. I'm sure we don't all sort of walk around thinking, you know, what are all my assets and what are all my liabilities and putting them in these buckets. But no doubt in the back of our mind we are sort of thinking about the actions that we're taking and how they affect our financial position. So, for example, you know, do I take out insurance or not? Might be a small cost now, but you know, the impact that may be a substantial saving if some event happens down the track. For example, you know, my sister-in-law, she's currently in the UK, been travelling over there. Unfortunately, you know, she took out the travel insurance policy before heading over to London and Germany before that. Not someone who's been blessed with the best health over her lifetime, so she has filled it in and said, I've got pre-existing conditions, and you know, gave some detail. You never know whether the insurance company is actually going to pay out anything on that until you actually do have to make a claim, but you know, she ticked the box that would protect her against that in the event that something does happen, which unfortunately has happened, and you know, at the minute she's actually there, still in hospital in the UK where she's been for the last 2 months and is quite, you know, seriously ill, unfortunately, but is improving, you know, gradually, and hopefully we'll get her home sometime soon. Initially, you know, she was sedated. One of the first questions she sort of started asking once I was sort of bringing her back from that sedation and starting to wake up is, where am I? Like, a fairly easy question. You're in hospital in London. No, that's not what she wanted to know. It's like, am I in a public hospital? And that, you know, obviously the UK, we have a reciprocal healthcare agreement. She's in the hospital in the UK. And the first thing she's thinking about, okay, what's this going to cost me? Tell me if I'm in a public hospital, then I know it's not going to cost me anything. So not specifically thinking about that personal balance sheet, but certainly thinking about what's this mean for my financial position there. She has taken out that travel insurance, and what we do know, they have accepted the claim, and yeah, that's given her additional comfort and yeah, more peace of mind as she works through her recovery there. Okay. Moving on, looking a little bit more at the analysis, to some extent we can like the decisions you know, individuals are going to make as they sort of come to and move through retirement, not unlike what it is for managing an insurance company. You know, we're having to make decisions about you know, how we spend our money, how we invest it. And you know, as we make those decisions, there's going to be different risks involved and you know, different ranges of outcome involved. So like the insurance company may have its risk appetite, each individual is also going to have their own risk appetite. That'll be you know, questions like things like, you know, what's my ability to fund my uncertain liabilities and over what time? How can I or how well can I fund my uncertain or discretionary spending on that? What's going to give me flexibility to meet those unexpected costs? And you know, as Anton said, you know, we're also potentially not spending money and holding it back for a bequest. As I make through and make these decisions, you know, what's the likelihood of you know, leaving a material bequest? For the analysis, we then thought about, okay, well, what would that mean in terms of risk measures? What sort of information can we analyse, derive and look at that might be useful to someone in making a decision about where they're going to invest that money? So, for example, you know, measures such as you know, probabilities of being able to meet the cash flow needs or target income over their lifetime. That's just you know, what's the median or percentiles for the you know, number of years they can meet their spending requirements. Over time, it might be you know, the assets I have over and above what's supported by the pension runs out. What's a measure of how much of that income I can you know, receive over my lifetime? If I start dipping into my home value to support my lifestyle, yeah, what percentage of you know, the home value would I potentially have to leave as a bequest in the longer term? And yeah, that would relate to the probability of or present value of having something to leave as a bequest. Right. In terms of then the actual analysis, we performed a you know, stochastic analysis, started with some 2000 scenarios, calibrated to economic conditions from 31 December 2014. So that's not to say we've just projected forward this current low interest rate environment. You know, they will have a view as to you know, conditions reverting back to more typical or higher economic conditions over time and projected out over a 40-year time frame. Like one of the sessions previously to us, yeah, we've used a simplified case, male, age 65, and just retired there. Defined and looked at for this individual, you know, the target income in line with the ASFA retirement standard for a comfortable lifestyle, which is around at the minute $42,500 per annum for a single person. We've also, in doing the analysis, considered the interaction of the retirement benefit with the age pension in two ways. One is to model it directly through the stochastic scenarios, exactly the interaction taking into account the asset and income test. In a second way was to do it more indirectly and say, well, my additional assets only have to fund a smaller part of that retirement income. So in this illustration, we've allowed for about $24,000, so similar to the part of the $42,500 that would be you know, not funded by the age pension at the outset. Assumed $300,000 superannuation savings, and in one case, for a homeowner with a home valued $500,000 versus a renter. And obviously for the renter, you know, we assumed they would be facing the additional costs of the rent, so we've allowed $15,000 per year for the rent. Do point out it is a simplified analysis. Some of the investment scenarios we've looked at, we'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute, but also things like, I haven't modelled tax for the obvious reason in post-retirement to keep it simple. We have projected out on the basis of the Australian life table mortality with an allowance for improvement, as Tony would wear, some of the things we've looked at are immediate annuities, but we haven't factored in selection in the pricing basis for those immediate annuities. For example, when we talk about investing in fixed interest, we've just invested in government bonds. So there's a number of simplifications through the analysis. So the results consider illustrative, not overly precise in that respect. Okay. As mentioned, we have looked at a number of different investment strategies, starting off with some relatively straightforward ones, a number of different allocated pension strategies just with different investment mix. First one, fixed interest, which, as I said, just in government bonds. Second one, just 100% in equity. Third one, balanced, and balanced that had 70% in equity, 30% in fixed interest. The allocated pension, the fourth one on the list there, is a little more complicated. They would sort of say, well, let's take a pot of money, put that in cash, that would fund our target spending over the next 3 years, put the balance into equity. The final two are then sort of say, well, let's build on the allocated pension with the balanced investment, but introduce some additional components. So first of all, if I get to the point where I've got enough money that I can buy a lifetime annuity that will meet my target spending needs, let's go ahead and buy that annuity and lock that in. And the final one is a further extension of that that looks at if I have a shortfall, even if I don't buy the lifetime annuity, can I dip into my home equity to supplement that target income and the implications for that on the measures. One of the measures we've looked at is a goodness of fit index, and this is not something we've derived. It's something that already exists. I think if you look up the challenges submission to the FSMI inquiry, one of the appendices from Towers Watson has more information on the goodness of fit index. Just put a formula up there, not intending to go too much through that. But a few of the characteristics of this goodness of fit index. First of all, something that lies between 0 and 1. If the index comes out at 0, that's saying you have no income on that. At the other end, 1 is saying your target income is fully met throughout the projection. It may be that you have more income than the target, but we're only taking into account the shortfall in deriving the index, not any excess. The other thing would be is it will give a higher result for a more uniform outcome. So, for example, if I receive 90% of my target income in every period, the result would come out to be 0.9. If I had 10% of the periods with zero income and the other periods, the other 90% at 100, the index would come out less. So it gives a higher or more favourable result if there's a steady outcome as opposed to a more volatile outcome. So quite a few numbers on this page. I'm not intending to go through them all, but just want to discuss some of the key variances or differentials between them. So what we have on this slide is results for the first three scenarios that we were looking at, so three where we're just invested in an allocated pension. As we go across, we have the median age of that funded to, the fifth percentile age, so 95% have exceeded that age, and then the goodness of fit index in terms of the median and fifth percentile, and in the last column, the probability that things are funded out to age 105 with the end of the projection period. To some extent, doesn't look overly good. Not in too many scenarios where I'm getting a good high value for the goodness of fit index, and low probability that I will actually have income all the way out to the end of the projection period. There might be some indication here towards just putting all your money in equity. You're getting perhaps slightly better results on some of the measures, but it is at increased volatility. The fifth percentile is generally going to be worse if you put all your money into equity as opposed to a balanced portfolio. Interest rates are currently low. The fixed interest doesn't look particularly attractive here. Other thing in terms of homeowner versus renter type scenario, the homeowner in this case is working out a little bit better. That's to some extent because the renter has additional costs. We've assumed they got the same amount in their superannuation fund, but only part of that additional cost is funded by the increase in the age pension. So overall, the renter under this scenario does have higher costs relative to the homeowner for the same resources. The other thing would be the interaction between what you have in your account-based pension and the age pension is really very important to the results of the analysis. So as your markets fluctuate, if my assets in my age pension go down somewhat, then the age pension can pick that up through its test and offset through some of that income. We've also, in terms of calculating the goodness of fit index, does take into account what that income from the age pension. So quite naturally, the goodness of fit index results, we've looked at the age pension on an inclusive basis, are naturally going to come out higher than when we're just looking at the age pension kind of exclusive. So just looking at income or target income in excess of the age pension. We've then moved on to sort of say, well, how would it compare if I do, as I say, invest in that immediate annuity if circumstances permit, or use the equity I have in my home to top up that income. First of all, for the allocated pension, just adding in the lifetime annuity, it doesn't really change a lot the median or the lower percentile ages of how long that age-based pension is going to last, or the median for the goodness of fit index. What it is, though, is going to, if I do lock in that lifetime annuity when circumstances permit, I've got a much higher probability, still not extremely high, 20-30%, that once I get to age 105, I've still got a significant income from the immediate annuity over and above just the age pension. If you take one step further and add in the possibility of making a drawdown on the home through an equity release type product, which we're treated as a line of credit. So as you run through, if there's a period where you need to top up your income to meet the target income, we'll draw down on that loan, so long as you're not exceeding the loan-to-value ratios that we define, starting, I think it was 15% age 65, increasing to 50 at age 100. I might be a little off there. What we do see there, drawing down, that then really does start and does come into these percentiles. So that goodness of fit index at the median is now 100%. So you've got a 50-50 chance that you can fully fund your target spending if you're willing to draw down on your home, assuming you're not a renter, obviously, on there. That then also increases the probability that by the time you get to age 105, you're still able to fully fund your retirement or target income spending. That though does come at a cost. Obviously, when we're just looking at the allocated pension, at the end you still would have owned 100% of the equity in the home for the homeowner case. Once we start drawing down, our equity in the home is obviously going to reduce. So just added a little table here to indicate that the median, though, you're still likely to own 50-60% of the equity in the home at the median level. At the lower percentiles, though, you may have very little or even zero equity in the home, and there will be scenarios where that equity has drop below zero. But in many of those scenarios, there's still significant equity in the home that available for a bequest or for other purposes should they be required. We then asked, a question that's a little bit out there, not suggesting anyone should do this, rather than staying in your home, let's sell up the home, put that extra $500,000 in the allocated pension, and see what happens. So we've looked at that for the scenario now, put it in the allocated pension, but invest in the lifetime annuity if the option arises. The goodness of fit index now at the median, a little bit below 100%, and that'll be reflective of, as we're projecting out the age pension, that's going, the immediate annuity that we purchase, that'll go up with price inflation where the target spending, we're assuming, is increasing with wage inflation with a slight reduction to reflect that, spending may come down over time. Yeah. At the same time, the probability of being funded to age 105 has gone up. So that's reflective. I've got more money, I'm more likely to actually then be able to be in a position to buy that lifetime annuity and lock that income in relative to the base scenario on that table. Also, though, just here demonstrating just on the last line that, be very careful. You might say, okay, I've got this big pot of money, I'm just going to be able to spend a bit more. Well, yes, you might be able to spend a bit more, but that has implications, and you're not going to be as well off as if you target the same level of income as before. Now, we're not saying anyone should be going out and buy the home. This was just a purely sort of theoretical question, but there are other options in between, such as downsizing from the home, freeing up some of the capital that you put in to investments and spread the usage of that over time. Yeah. As we sort of work through the analysis, it's clear every individual is going to be different. They're going to have different views as to what's optimal. Because of that, there's not going to be any one optimal solution. In terms of our analysis, we've looked at a limited range and illustrated how that behaves for a range of risk measures. But what's right for one person isn't going to be right for everybody else. Also talked about retirement. It is a progressive journey. People, I think to a large extent, like flexibility, like to know they're going to be able to meet those uncertain cash flows as they arise. The more money, for example, you may lock into a lifetime annuity, the less flexibility you have. The longer you own the home, the more flexibility you have to use that equity for other purposes. But it's also something that's going to be reviewed over time. It may not be the right time now to buy a lifetime annuity in a low interest rate environment, but I also have the option of buying that at a later time on that. Definitely scope for alternative products. So in what we'd illustrated there, utilising the equity release fundamentally changes those risk measure outcomes in this case, and there's certainly room for other products such as mortality pooling products, deferred lifetime annuities, and so forth. There's also opportunity to enhance the advice that we're giving to individuals to enable them to make informed choices, whether that's through a superannuation entity or through our advice channels. Results that are along the lines of just how much money do I need to fund my retirement? Well, there's no single answer to that. It's going to be up to each individual, how much they view they need to spend, how much they're comfortable to lock away, what level of risk they're prepared to take on. So we should be getting in a position to offer people a range of solutions and information that enables them to make informed choices in line with their own risk appetite. Defining a default for superannuation, for example, is going to be very challenging, and exactly for that reason. The superannuation fund doesn't just have one average member. You know, it's a pool of members with diverse characteristics. The last point was just there around engagement. And obviously, the more you can engage with members of super funds and other members in the public, increase their awareness of what are the options out there, what are the range of, or getting used to presenting results in a way that's understandable to them. You know, perhaps a goodness of fit index isn't, in itself isn't the solution, but it's something that can be used with a range of other measures so they understand not just how much money am I going to get, but yeah, just the variability of the product mix that they select and what the impact of that variability may be on the outcome. On that. So increasing that engagement now or just over time certainly will enable better communication with the superannuation fund members on that. So with that, just Anton, any additional comments? Pass over for questions.
All right, guys, just before we move on to questions, maybe a round of applause for John and Anton. And if anyone would like to ask questions, there's two mics just on the side aisles, and if you just open with your name first. Thanks.
Thanks, gentlemen. James Hickey from Deloitte. I really like the use of equity release. I've been an advocate of the equity release sector for over 10 years now, and as Deloitte, we do an annual survey into the market and the volumes and the usage of the product. I'd say, though, to make equity release be considered by households and their personal balance sheet, providers need to make a very conscious effort to promote the potential uses of the product. I don't think there's any major bank or major life insurer out there at the moment that is actively promoting the benefits of what that product could offer for retirees. Not to say it's a solution for everyone, but I just wonder how much it'll be considered by households without the implicit endorsement of our large institutions in the marketplace to say, hey, this is a product, it has potential benefits, it's worthwhile of consideration.
No, I'd agree with that. Also, I think from a government and a policy perspective, you know, encouraging structures that that either push or pull people towards that would help. So the obvious one is means test the house.
It's perhaps little known that the government itself has its own equity release product available as well on that. So I think the government recognises that they could certainly do a lot more to raise awareness of that.
Hi there, Nicolette Rubenstein. We've actually sort of done a similar analysis that we're presenting tomorrow. In the beginning of your presentation, you listed a whole load of different products that you were comparing, but you only seemed to show the results for some of the comparisons. So you didn't include the group self-annuitisation or the variable annuity or the deferred annuity. Maybe I missed that. Does your paper cover all of the options?
No, we haven't looked to cover all those options, but yeah, we certainly recognise that there's going to be benefits to other products that we haven't included in the analysis.
Or in a more complex strategies, like if you go down and drill into your spending needs and say that there is a real need and discretionary layer and so on, you could, for example, look at different weightings to say that funding your needs is more important than funding your sort of layers of discretionary spend. And then, for example, using a lifetime annuity at retirement to cover a minimum level of spend would be a valid strategy. So there's a whole range of ways to extend the analysis.
Hi, Mike Thornton from AMP. I'm not sure whether this is a question, guys, or just a comment, but I'll kick off and see where I head. So I think I've just spent the last 2 hours with probably about 150 actuaries looking at how to optimise retirement incomes. And I guess if we can't figure that out, what hope is there for the Australian consumer and the man in the street? the stakes are clearly very high for the Australian taxpayer, given the underpin of the age pension, increasing longevity and the like. So I guess I'm left with the thought that we've got a very real role we need to play in the industry. And if we don't step into that void and influence policymakers and stakeholders quite broadly, I guess I fear for the for where retirement products may head and the consequences for taxpayers. So I guess that's a statement.
Definitely agree. If you know, as a group of people, you know, we'd be sort of on top of this sort of, if you sort of stack the population, we'd have probably the greatest understanding of all this, and it's not immediately obvious what the answer is. So, as you said, the average person in the street is really going to struggle. You know, the average financial advisor is going to struggle. So yeah, it's not a simple problem to solve. And there are two angles to attacking it. One is how do you get individuals to make an optimal decision for themselves, and then how do you get, say, policy settings to arrive at an optimal or near optimal outcome for sort of the economy as a whole. And the second question is perhaps a little bit easier to solve than the first.
Martin Mulcair. Thanks, Anton. Thanks, John. I like the concept of the personal balance sheet, and I certainly agree that retirement is not a point-in-time event. I've got a question maybe following on from Mike's, and depending on your answer, I might then make a comment. When you put the paper together, and I must confess I didn't read it in the last 12 hours, when you put the paper together, who did you see as your primary audience for the modelling? I wasn't sure there was... product manufacturers, a lot of people hear about how best to position, market, design the product, whether it was advisors helping consumers make these decisions, or whether you actually had in mind you know, consumers being informed.
I think from my perspective it would have been product manufacturers, but perhaps as a proxy for both policymakers and advisors, in that, you know, the manufacturers are going to have a role in influencing policy direction, and obviously have a key role in educating advisors.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd certainly agree with that. I think if we look at the end individuals making decisions, you know, obviously we need much simpler presentation than a table of numbers that, you know, is not going to convey a lot to that audience. So certainly in terms of what we have in the paper, very much at the, you know, the product manufacturer level.
And I guess also in terms of actually reaching out across a broad spectrum of the population, you know, financial advisors aren't going to be able to speak to a very high proportion of retirees. There just aren't enough financial advisors in the country. So therefore, you know, you fall back on product manufacturers, you know, developing, you know, robo-advice models over time, and how that can then get rolled out to, you know, the real mass market.
Yeah. Okay. No, I won't pursue it. I'll have a chat another time about roles of advisors and also roles of superannuation funds and looking after members who may not be able to get sophisticated advice. And that's helpful. Thank you.
Hi, Anthony Asher. Thanks, guys. Almost every session, parallel session, there's something on annuity, so I'm partly in advertising my session tomorrow afternoon. But I put it to you in terms of the debate, in terms of how we move this thing forward, and I think Mike's comment about, you know, if we can't solve this problem, no one has got a chance, because it's really core to the actuarial problem. This is a multi-criteria issue, and you've raised a number of the criteria and got different measures for each of them. Now, it seems if you're going to do it, put it together, you actually have to add them and weight them in some way. And you do that by asking clients what actually, how their weights are. So, I mean, the challenge is to then effectively to devise some type of coherent utility function that captures all of those things. And I say you need to capture all of these things, and you can, because money is fungible. So you don't have buckets for money. You put them all together and you find an optimum situation. So the one question is that, sort of how do one just develop a coherent utility function? And the second comment is, I'm really concerned about the use of any shortfall measures, which I think you have a couple of. Shortfall measures naturally lead you to gambling, and gambling is wrong a priori. Because you've always, if you've got a shortfall measure, you are then driven towards a decision that minimizes the shortfall, but can cost you a huge amount if you fall short. You basically ignore everything underneath. It's the same problem we have with VAR and tail VAR and that type of stuff. So the question I would have is, you know, have you dealt with the shortfall measure? Would you end up with encouraging gambling with the measures that you've got?
I certainly don't encourage gambling with people's superannuation money. I guess the other thing I'd say, I wouldn't necessarily say a shortfall measure is the only valid measure. We'd view it more as, you know, one piece of information that should or could potentially be available to people in terms of making those decisions. I also agree with the first part of what you say in terms of, you know, if you have too many measures, you know, it's not going to make sense. Having the way to bring it into something, you know, more appropriate or more narrow for a particular individual, you know, I think is important. And that comes from understanding for that individual, you know, what's important to them. And you know, that'll lead or weight to, you know, different types of measures.
Yeah. I mean, I take the point that it's nice to be able to collapse things to a single metric, but I don't know that, you know, money obviously is fungible, but I don't know that you can necessarily trade off, for example, you know, a slightly higher probability of being able to afford the European holiday versus a slightly higher probability of having to fall back on the age pension after age 100. There's no obvious way to really weigh up those two things. The only other comment with the shortfall measures, I think maybe not purely addressing your concern, but given that we weren't taking credit for sort of upside beyond the target income, I think that, if anything, pushes you towards less risky rather than more risky options.
I think we probably have time for one more question, very quick one.
Interested in aged care. I mean, Anton, you put it well when people may have a one-off expenditure. At the moment, I think aged care is the biggest one-off expenditure that people may be faced with, and it's a huge area of uncertainty. If they're suddenly forced to go into aged care or their partner is, there's $400,000, stump it up, pay for that bond. How have you factored this in? Where do you think that may come in the personal household balance sheet consideration?
You're right. So, I mean, we sort of danced around it in that we just sort of lumped that in with the uncertain expenditure bucket. So, one of our criteria was flexibility. So, coming back to, you know, can you come up with a unified measure? Well, you can't, because it's a binary outcome whether one of those events occurs or not. So I think it's a sort of a scenario analysis that, you know, this could happen. This strategy lets you cope with it better than that strategy. Make a trade-off.
All right, guys, I think that's about it. Another round of applause for Anton and John.